From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
It is a series of tough choices, but the choice that I'd like to present today is to do all we can as a state to assist those who are struggling around our state and to do no more harm.
We are putting this burden on generations of people that will follow us here. And if you think we're having trouble today paying our bills, think about what's going to happen over the next 30 years as we try to pay this money back.
All areas of the state are eligible to reopen in accordance with Restore Illinois Phase 3, which offers specific guidance on how things like outdoor dining, outdoor recreation, manufacturing, retail, personal care services, and offices can move forward with safety measures in place.
Well, the state of Illinois moving into Phase 3 of the governor's plan for reopening. We'll discuss that and also recap the legislative session. It finally ended last weekend. Lawmakers passed a state budget, but still a lot of questions remain. That's all ahead on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel is practicing social distancing. From his home, we have Charlie Wheeler. He's an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Joining us also is NPR Illinois reporter Sam Dunklaw and Bill Wheelhouse, who's reporting for NPR Illinois during the pandemic. And our guest this week, Rebecca Enzel. She covers government and politics for Capital News Illinois. Rebecca, good to have you on once again.
Thanks for having me.
Sam, I'll go to you first. Phase 3, I mentioned it, the governor now moving the state ahead in his plan. We apparently have gotten to a point where he's comfortable enough that some of these things that are allowed in Phase 3 can take place. What has happened to allow the state to get to this point?
Well, you might remember this, or listeners might remember this from way back when, but when the Restore Illinois plan came out, there were some important metrics that the state was going to be paying attention to in order to figure out whether or not individual regions or the state all by itself, together as one, could move from one phase to the other. And those are a region had to have a positivity rate, that is a COVID-19 test positivity rate, of 20% or less. So if you have 100 people, only 20 of them or fewer have to be testing positive for COVID-19. And that can be, there could not have been an increase of more than 10% over a 14-day period. And that's about the length of time that it takes for the virus to incubate. On top of that, a region had to see stability or a decrease in hospital admissions for COVID-like illnesses for those who had the symptoms or who were kind of on the borderline across a 28-day period. Now, that had kind of gotten the governor a little bit of raised eyebrows and saying, you know, New York had a similar metric, for example, but they only instituted a 14-day period. The state was a little bit unclear as to why they chose to do double that amount of time, but that is what the state has ultimately gone with. So the Department of Public Health website has these metrics up for all four regions of the state. For the northeastern region, for the north central, for the central Illinois region, and the southern Illinois region. You can watch these daily. And as time went on, our positivity rate across the state slowly decreased to where it is now. It was at one time closer to 20, and now I think it's down to somewhere around 8%, if I remember from the DPH release from just the other day. And every region met it. We weren't sure if Chicago and the collar counties were going to meet those metrics later on, and so they would have had to stay in Phase 2. But somewhere around mid-month, they met up with the rest of the state and met those benchmarks of under 20% and a stability in hospitalization admissions. So that's where we're at. Most notably now, hair salons, and barbers and some other so-called non-essential businesses are now able to open starting today, and restaurants and bars are able to serve their guests in an outdoor patio setting. Now, indoor seating is still not allowed, but if a restaurant has an ability to be able to seat outdoors, that is now allowed.
So it's not back to normal, Rebecca, but it's a step toward that, I would think. And for now, it probably gives people at least a feeling as though the state's going in the right direction.
Yeah, there are so many people across the state, as evidenced by the unemployment numbers, that work in retail settings, that work for fitness clubs, that work for restaurants, bars, and other quote-unquote non-essential businesses that have been out of work for months now. By allowing outdoor seating for restaurants and bars, it allows waiters and waitresses and chefs to begin working again. Fitness clubs can have outdoor classes in groups of no more than 10 people. So that allows those people to get back to work as well. This is definitely not back to, you know, pre-March sort of regularity, but it is a step in that direction.
Charlie, for the economy, it's still just a half of a loaf here. We're not talking about getting things back up and running fully. So it won't make everyone happy. And the governor has faced some criticism over the last several weeks. So it may take a little pressure off temporarily, but it's not again, like I said, not a full loaf.
No, and it's probably not going to be back to normal. What we would recall as being normal, say, from 4 or 5 months ago, it may never get back to that degree of normalcy. Certainly, there will be social distancing guidelines for stores, for restaurants. Even when you can dine inside, you're not going to be able to be packed side by side. So we're going to have to adjust to kind of a new normalcy, I guess you might call it, where we have to be aware of the fact that this disease is out there. And certainly, we have to be very cautious until there is, well, two things. One, an effective treatment, and secondly, a vaccine that will protect people against getting it. So, for example, theater owners are unhappy because they think that they should be allowed to have more people in for the movies than what the guidelines, even the expanded guidelines, would permit. But on the other hand, will people really want to go in a crowded movie theater if there's the danger that you may be exposing yourself to something? Part of the difficulty, as we all know, is that you really can't tell who may be carrying this virus because it doesn't always show up in people. You don't always have the symptoms. So I could have it and unknowingly infect everybody I contact without having any idea that I'm a carrier.
Bill, when this pandemic started, a lot of people, I think, were scared. The unknown that you know bothered a lot of folks. The governor was taking action, and most of the state population has gone along with that. But as things have progressed, there have been fewer cases in some locations. This really has turned more political, and we've started to see that. We saw that during the legislative session, I think, as well, with you know people being critical of the governor. We even have a state representative who's wanting to start a recall effort. We'll talk about that in a moment, but Pritzker facing some real pushback here, isn't he?
He has faced pushback from different areas throughout. It started kind of as a rural-urban split, I thought. During the legislative session, as minority parties are wont to do, regardless of how strong necessarily leaders felt, Republicans staked out the strategy that they should be opposed to a lot of the governor's shutdown or the slowness in reopening. And that they were stressing that throughout the time. And they would make calls at the end of the legislative session that different things along those lines needed to be debated or discussed. And it was your traditional whoever is in the minority party making claims that they don't have to worry about whether they're right or wrong. They're just in opposition.
Well, Alan Skillicorn is the state representative I was mentioning before, a Republican from Crystal Lake. He's the one who has started this, at least called for this recall effort. A lot to go into that. Rebecca, you wrote about his call for it, and what is his reasoning behind this?
So he's saying that the lack of staffing at the Illinois Department of Employment Security and that department's website's disclosure of sensitive information is sort of evidence of Governor Pritzker's, quote-unquote, continued inaction. He's basically saying that there's not enough people working the phone banks, to which Pritzker has said he can't hire a ton of people due to federal regulations and the training that, those call center agents have to go through. And then to Skillicorn's allegation of sort of website impropriety of one claimant has sort of was able to see a whole bunch of sensitive information of thousands of other Illinoisans. The governor has said that they fixed that. And it was only one person who saw it. And the department is pretty much assured that that one person isn't going to do anything with that information. So he does need significant lawmaker support before this can go anywhere, though. And it's unlikely that he's going to receive the amount of Democratic support that he needs.
Yeah, Charlie, does he have a point here? I mean, he certainly there's been some criticisms of the governor and of the Department of Employment Security website, things like that. But recall seems like a pretty strong step to take.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, the requirements for recall are designed, at least in my estimation, to be unworkable. And the reason I say that is before petitions can be circulated and before voters can decide, yes, we want to throw the bum out, there has to be a affidavit filed with the Board of Elections signed by, I believe it is, and Rebecca, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it is 20 representatives, 10 senators, equally divided between the two parties. And at that point, a petition can be filed, and you can start collecting signatures, and you have a pretty limited time to collect almost 700,000 signatures. And if that occurs, then there will be a special election set within a matter of months. So it seems to me that if there was enough bipartisan support thinking that this governor should go, that you could get a decent number of the majority party to join with the minority party, the quicker and more effective way to remove the governor would be to simply impeach him, as they did with Rod Blagojevich. It cost relatively little. We didn't need a special election. We didn't need to gather petitions and signatures. We didn't have to go through all that process. When we decided the guy should go, the lawmakers threw him out. So it occurs to me that an easier way to remove a governor who's really failed is just to impeach him rather than go through all this rigmarole of getting the affidavits and the signatures and all the rest of a special election, as is spelled out by what I said earlier, is an unworkable recall provision.
But Charlie, you're not saying that he has necessarily risen to the level of impeachment either at this point.
Oh, no. I'm speaking hypothetically.
And
when the decision was made to remove Rod Blagojevich, supposing we would have decided, well, we're going to recall him. So we would have gotten the signatures from both parties easily enough, but then we would have had to go out and collected almost 700,000 signatures of voters who wanted to kick him out, and it would have had to been a special election, and then there would have been an election at the same time to replace him, and the cost and expense and the time would have been a lot greater and a lot more burdensome than simply having the House vote articles of impeachment and the Senate convict.
And as Charlie talks about that, it's just what Illinois is. Any citizen referendum as well in the state of Illinois is always difficult. We're not California. It's always been made difficult in Illinois to get ballot initiatives forth. But I think the other thing worth keeping in mind, it probably has hit on a bipartisan issue. People are very frustrated if they're trying to collect unemployment right now and having trouble getting through, and this has been a frustrating nightmare for a lot of folks.
Well, another level of criticism has come from a lot of faith leaders in the state who have felt as though they could reopen their churches, synagogues, mosques, and do it in a way that still practice social distancing, still being safe. But the governor's plan earlier had said, you know, still a limit on gatherings of more than 10 people. Sam, the governor has now backed off of some of that mandate, and instead they put out guidance for churches. Can you give us a quick overview of that?
Yeah, so different faith groups took it differently. The Thomas More Society called it a complete and total victory. I think different folks are taking this announcement from just the other day in different ways. But before, there were mandatory restrictions on faith celebrations. As a faith celebration in most faiths, it requires a gathering of a large amount of people. The State Department of Public Health had said, okay, well, there can be no more than 10 people, you know. The Catholic Church, for example, under the leadership of the Archdiocese of Chicago, had set up a very specific regimented schedule for reopening churches, for allowing these larger services. The certain volunteers were going to have to get training. All of these things were already in place. And now what the governor has done is said, instead of making these mandatory, they are just simply, well, suggestions, guidelines. Not necessarily mandatory restrictions like suggestions on capacity limits, new cleaning protocols, suggesting that indoor gatherings be limited to 10 people or less, reducing activities like, for example, the sharing of communion, a communal source of whatever it may be, and safely conducting outdoor services, which some churches have opted to do. Those suggestions, of course, have not stopped a lot of churches. As a matter of fact, right here in Springfield, the Diocese of Springfield released a large announcement saying we will resume public masses beginning this next weekend. There will be capacity limits and there will be social distancing and all the rest of this, but that there will still be definitely more than 10 people attending Mass that weekend. Again, what it sort of boils down to is that I think the governor was facing pressure on a lot of different sides, as some of the other guests I'm sure will weigh in on. The Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who was already involved because he oversees the Seventh Federal Circuit, had sort of put the hammer down to say the state must respond to these charges that are being thrown out by several church groups who have filed lawsuits claiming freedom of religion infringement. You must respond to this by tonight. As a matter of fact, the state of Illinois has until 8 o'clock tonight to respond to some of these suits. And so facing pressure from that, the guidance went from mandatory to suggesting. We will see who ends up following that in the end.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford. The panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Sam Dunklaw, Bill Wheelhouse, and Rebecca Anzell with Capital News Illinois. Well, I mentioned that the Illinois legislature met over the last weekend, and it took them a little longer to get things done. The big thing they had to get done was pass a state budget. Charlie, your thoughts on that spending plan that was put together?
Well, I think in the times we're in, I suppose it was about the best you could do. And as one of the Republicans said, I believe it was Representative Demers, this is built on a wing and a prayer because it relies on borrowing up to $5 billion from the Federal Reserve's Municipal Liquidity Facility Program, which is basically the Federal Reserve has set up this slush fund that states and local governments can borrow from. And we're saying, well, if needs be, we're going to borrow up to $5 billion to cover our costs. And the Republicans argued, well, you should have made cuts. But on the other hand, it's not really clear where you can make cuts at a time like this. And I think Governor Pritzker and the Democrats argued this is not the time to make cuts. This is a time when government needs to step in and help people. Most everything in the budget was held flat. For example, there was no increase in aid to elementary and secondary education to follow the guidelines, the requirements of the evidence-based formula, which would have required, I believe, something like $350 million new dollars this year. That didn't happen. Higher education was held flat. The only increases were in items related to the pandemic, departments like public health, And so it was the best you could do under bad circumstances, but it's not at all balanced in terms of there being real dollars there to support the spending allocations.
So Bill, what happens if they can't get this money from the federal government? Are they just going to have to make adjustments as the year goes on?
Well, I think they'll be able to get the money from the federal government because it's a program set up to borrow from the Fed. Regardless of whether they get the money, though, I think there's going to be adjustments made throughout the year. It's more of a guideline document and really less of a budget in many respects than a guide.
Well, one of the things we heard a lot about this week had to do with pay raises for legislators. If you talk to Republicans, they're saying that the Democrats pushed through the legislative pay raise. And, of course, the Democrats are now saying, no, that's not the case. Charlie, you were talking about this before we started the show. Can you give us the overview of where this issue stands? The average person's probably quite confused.
The overview is that the Democrats say we've provided $0. There's a line item in the budget that says for these cost of living increases, and then the figure is zero. And so they're correct. There is no money in the budget for it. On the other hand, Republicans argue, and I think they have the stronger case, that because a few years ago the appropriation for legislative salaries was made a continuing appropriation, which means that the money is, there's authority for the comptroller and the treasurer to pay these expenses even though there is no money for them in the budget. And, for example, during the budget impasse, that's what allowed us to pay, make our contributions to the five pension systems, the fact that that's a continuing appropriation. So it doesn't matter whether there's zero in the budget or not. The law says that the money has to be paid. Now, the comptroller is saying, I'm not going to do it. And she can continue to say that until someone goes to court and says, the law is clear. We're entitled to this money. You have to pay us. At that point, she would be obligated to do so, I would believe. As a matter of fact, there's a suit that's been filed, and I'm not sure what the current status of it is, but it was in Cook County. A couple former lawmakers argued that after they left office, they argued that they should have gotten the cost of living adjustments that were foregone during the time that they were in the General Assembly because a previous Supreme Court ruling had held that cost of living is part of the salary. And the Constitution forbids changes in salary during the term for which a lawmaker is elected. And so the circuit court agreed with them, and I couldn't find out what the situation was with the case at the moment. But as I said earlier, it seems to me the bottom line is that ultimately they'll get the pay raises over Mendoza's protests.
Well, another thing, go ahead.
Mendoza, when she has her political ads, when she runs for office next time, will be able to say she helped fight against pay raises.
Yeah, but and the pay raises this time around, it's based on a 2.5% increase in a U.S. Department of Labor, statistic measuring the changes in pay. It's an employment index for people who are in state and local government employee. And it works out to roughly, I believe the number for legislature based on their salary, with 2.5% increase for cost of living, comes out to roughly $1,700. Their salary of roughly $69,500, their base salary.
Just a few seconds left here in the show, but I did want to mention, and Bill, maybe you can fill us in on this just real quickly, an election package moved through. What will that change?
Well, it will allow more opportunity for people of Illinois to get an application in the mail at the beginning to vote by mail. And that creates sometimes more controversy than evidence shows maybe it should. But there are some people who are just dead set against voting by mail. And that is the biggest portion of that election bill. It will also expand in-person voting hours in the few weeks before the election, too.
And real quickly, Sam, a gambling legislation moved through, and the big part of that really has to do with the Chicago casino.
Right. So as you might remember, there was a survey that was done a long time ago that said that the current tax rate that would have been put on a Chicago casino would have been really unsupportable by any private bidder who would want to come in and make the casino. It would have been essentially unprofitable, 1-2% profit margin. So nobody would want to build it. So essentially what the legislation in Springfield changed up was it moved that kind of high rate to a graduated rate of between 12-40%, depending on how much money essentially the casino brings in. And that they're hoping will attract the right bidder to be able to put the casino up in the first place.
Time now for our notes from the field. And Rebecca, let's go to you first.
One thing lawmakers didn't get to was a bill that would sort of further extend the governor's emergency protections for tenants who may not be able to pay their rent, some mortgage payers who couldn't afford that either. The bill couldn't reach enough votes in the House or the Senate. And so the lawmakers instead decided to allocate additional funds to the appropriate Illinois department to sort of administer a program that way.
All right, Bill.
We hear sometimes doctors not taking patients on Medicaid over the last decade or two, and doctors will actually be getting an increase for treating Medicaid patients. They will see an increase, and the doctors groups say that they expect 1 million more people in the state to be on the Medicaid rolls in the coming year.
Charlie?
Well, the impact of the pandemic is going to be fairly long-lasting. University of Illinois' Institute of Government and Public Affairs released a report this week that forecasts the loss of more than 550,000 jobs in the Illinois economy by next March, with the biggest losses expected in the resources, services, trade, and construction sectors. And they point out that one of the big differences between previous recessions is the fact that there is this continued public health threat, which might cause Illinois residents to continue to limit their economic activity. People may be afraid to go back to work. The public may not want to take the chance of going to sporting events, cultural activities, leisure facilities, those kinds of things. So unlike past recessions, this whole public health aspect makes it very difficult to figure out what's ahead.
And Sam?
Our colleagues up at WGLT reported that two ISU freshmen have filed a lawsuit against that university for not refunding enough of their mandatory student fees. The university there refunded about $12 per credit hour, but each of these students say they paid over $1,000 in fees and that refund just simply wasn't adequate.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Sam Dunklaw, Bill Wheelhouse, and Rebecca Enzel with Capital News Illinois. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org or through the NPR One app. Production assistance for the program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.